Hello, welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice webcast, podcast, videocast thing. I'm always excited to do these things, but particularly today, really, really interesting guest who's just delivered a very significant piece of work for community pharmacy, particularly in England, but probably will have ramifications elsewhere as well. On this morning, we've got Professor David Wright, who is Professor of Pharmacy Practice at the University of East Anglia. David, hello, good morning. Now we're going to talk about your report that you were commissioned to do recently on community pharmacy in England. But how have you been? How has lockdown been for you?
Good morning, Jonathan. I've enjoyed lockdown, to be honest with you. I suddenly realised that I can work from home, and actually I've got my young children, so actually spending a lot of time with them has been a real bonus for me. But trying to manage a 9-to-5 job and write this report, because obviously this is on top of my normal day job, and look after two children, pick them up, feed them and everything, has been quite entertaining for 4 months, but normality is starting to arrive.
Yeah, it's been... The cliche is new normal, of course, but it's, I think we've gone through, because I've got two young kids as well, I think we've gone through the, like, that team building thing, you know, the forming, storming, norming, performing. I think we're reaching performing now with the kids, but getting into that routine of trying to work when they're there is quite difficult. So that's good to hear. I've enjoyed lockdown as well, actually. It's I think it's shifted how we think, and maybe forced us to think a little bit differently in terms of what's possible. So,
yeah, it's interesting. When I wrote the report, I submitted it just after lockdown started, to be honest, because that was my deadline, April the 1st. And I put in, one of the recommendations was, I reckon we should use a lot more virtual technology. That should save us a lot of money. And I wrote it thinking, well, it'll take about 10 years to happen, but that's somewhere where we could make some savings in the system. Of course, COVID has brought that forward so rapidly, and all of a sudden I hear all the local pharmaceutical committees are now just doing their meetings online, and that saves rooms, meals, travel. It means also you can do these things whilst you're in your pharmacy. You don't actually have to get out of the place, you know. So it's totally transformed it. But it was nice that I didn't actually change my recommendation as a result. I'd already kind of seen this, but didn't expect it to happen anywhere near so quickly.
Very good. Yeah, and we've had similar up in Scotland. You know, up in Scotland where the grass is green and the sun shines brighter. We've had second only to Ireland, of course. We've had the NHS Near Me program rolled out led by Claire Morrison, and of course that is just, COVID has driven that, and that's just been a sweeping use of remote communication technology across all the disciplines, really. So yeah, it's been a unusual time. So to this report, as you can tell, I'm pretty interested, excited. I read it, as I read a lot of things these days for pharmacy practice, with one eyebrow up. But by the time I got halfway through the executive summary, I was gripped, to be honest. I don't think it's unfair to say you haven't held back. So you know, you've just, I mean, I'll put a link to the report, but for the benefit of the viewers and the listeners, you've basically sort of suggested a complete rubbing out and redrawing of the community pharmacy contractor representation model in England. Would that be fair to say? Do you want to take us through sort of your highlights or real key significant recommendations?
Yeah, so you're right, I haven't held back, but I was given one remit. I was given the remit of finding what was the best model for contractors and how best to use their money to get them the best deal. When I came into this, I didn't realise it would be anywhere near as dramatic as the report. I set some standards at the start, and I actually used the words, you'll see, this should be evolution, not revolution. And actually, I look at my final recommendations and they're evolution. They're much bigger than that. But actually, having listened to everybody, and I listened to everybody, really did, contractors, employers, the NHS England, yourselves up in Scotland and also Wales as well, as well as the GP world, and having listed all those, it all coalesced actually quite rapidly. The signals were very clear as to what the issues were: massive dissatisfaction with our national contract, dissatisfaction with the local representation because of the variation in the quality and the way it was delivered, and the lack of transparency in the whole system from the top to the bottom. So the PSNC, who do the national negotiations, nobody really knew what they're doing. They were called a secret society by many. And the LPCs, when we looked at their websites, actually finding what they were doing, how they're spending the money, was very difficult in many cases. And so as a contractor, if that was me spending my £1,000 a year, I wouldn't have an idea where that £1,000 was being spent or how it was being spent or whether it was good value for money. Mm. So one of the clear messages was, we need some governance in the system. The PSNC, the national body, don't answer to anybody. The LPCs are autonomous bodies, and that's how they were set up. And so there's no oversight, and there's no requirement for anybody to look at or for them to show the contractors what they're doing. So obviously the first recommendation is about exactly that, transparency, having a governance body. And it's difficult bringing a governance body in if no one has to answer to it, because they're autonomous. They don't actually need to sign up. It's kind of going to have to be a voluntary system, a bit like we have with our media and such like, rather than a legislated one. And so to lever that, you've got to have a process whereby those contractors, those LPCs, kind of buy into the system. So the other thing that came out was what I noticed when I looked at Community Farm Scotland, I looked at GP land, is that the local representative bodies actually form the national body. It's a bit like parliament. I mean, it's kind of the obvious way you do things. You vote for your MP locally, they then represent you in government and they negotiate and make the laws. In pharmacy in England, you kind of have your local representative and then you have a national representative, and the two have this tenuous link of these 13 regional representatives who work incredibly hard, but 13 regions across England is quite difficult. And therefore, you can see why there's mistrust between the two. They don't really know what each other's doing, the LPCs and the PSNC. And actually, it's kind of not working well for contractors. The contractors clearly say, my voice is not heard. Those people at the top don't know what it's like at the bottom. And I'm sure they do, actually. And they all own big businesses. Some of them still practice, a number of them still practice. But actually, the perception, which is what's important here by the contractors, those people at the top don't know what it's like to be us and don't understand the position we're in. So the second recommendation, the big one really, is to replace what's called the PSNC, the National Negotiating Committee, with a council of chairs from the local pharmaceutical committee. So that council of about 50 to 60 will meet four times a year, and they will decide the policy, what it is we need to do to move forward as part of community pharmacy. And I use the word we because I'm a community pharmacist through and through. I only gave up my practice 4 years ago because of the twins that we had, and I was told I was no longer allowed to practice and be a full-time professor and everything else. And I kind of regret that in many respects, because I always loved being a community pharmacist. But, you know, for that contractor's voice to be heard, they need to be close to the centre. And the way to deliver that is to move the LPCs into the centre and give them responsibility for that national negotiation. The other thing is that came through a lot was the negotiations. Obviously, the prediction is a total reduction in income for Community Pharmacy England by 25% over a number of years. That's how the negotiations have gone. And so a lot of people said we need a professional negotiating team. And at the moment, the negotiating team is derived from people from that management senior committee, and they are not employed. There's no sort of real governance for them either. So what I've recommended is that we actually employ four negotiators, so that actually they actually are employed and responsible to this governance body, and they are trained and they operate as a team. And what's really interesting when I went to see the GPs was how they put so much effort into that negotiation. It's not just the negotiation itself, but actually preparing for that negotiation. So what they've done is actually they've got policy groups to think about all things to do with GP land. So that when they go into that negotiation, they know what the priorities are, they know what they need to do to get where they want to get to, and kind of they've done all the thinking. The other things they've done really well, they've got a massive comms team that works with the public to get the public behind them. So when they have an idea, they know the public are going to support that idea. And all that work goes into, so the kind of negotiation process is kind of the end of a lot of work, not the start of a new lot of work, so to speak. And so that, so you know, people have said, oh, the GPs are very good. They actually said, can we get the GPs to negotiate on our behalf because they do such a good job? And obviously they're kind of, we work with them, but they're competitors. That wouldn't be the way forward. But I think there's certain things in their model we should take. And so obviously the other recommendation is to employ a professional team to who work with that council, overseen by the governance body. And that it's a total transformation from where we are now. It's a real modernization of the process. I've also said we need to spend more on comms. We need to spend more on promoting the voice of community pharmacy. And embedded around all of that is we need a single voice. I think the issue with the contracting and the negotiating is that we're not a single voice. We go into that room and we have different bodies with different desires and targets, not all working together. And I think it makes it too easy for NHS England when they're negotiating with us. And so I think, you know, once you've got a counselling board, you've got a governance body who are going to help with strategy, I think they need to work together and agree a vision. We've just negotiated a five-year contract, and one person said to me, and it really shocked me when they said it, said, negotiate a five-year contract, but we don't know what we want at the end of those 5 years. So we don't actually know where we're going. So we're going to negotiate five-year contracts. We need to set ourselves targets and monitor our progress against it, and we need to negotiate with that in mind. So the next time it comes around in 3.5 years' time, you know, we need to be in a position where we know what we want, we know what our vision is, and we know what steps we need to take. And within that, what's interesting is we don't very often think holistically about community pharmacy. So our GP colleagues, their new contract has created lots of jobs for pharmacy. They realised, short-staffed, they can see no more GPs coming through rapidly. So they want physiotherapists, they want pharmacists, they want a bigger team. So in their negotiation, they went in and said, actually, what we want out of this is not more money to ourselves, but more money to our team and to employ other healthcare professionals. And when we go in, we don't go in and say, well, actually, can you give us funding for pharmacy technician training, which is what our NHS colleagues and our primary care colleagues, can you give us funding for our community pharmacists to actually have time to train, deliver, rather than the employer have to pay that? Can you help us all become prescribers, which they are doing in every other part of the NHS? And those sort of things we just don't think about within the negotiation process at the moment. So I'm kind of, what I'm recommending in the report is that we have a much more holistic approach, a much more prepared approach. And when we go in, we know the politicians and the public are behind us and we are together. And I think with all those things lined up, NHS England will have to listen far more carefully and we're in a far less strong position than they are at the moment. So yes, in a nutshell, it is a radical change, but all for the benefit of the contractor, because at the moment our contract is not great. And I think community pharmacy is really struggling in England as a result of that.
Yeah, there's so much within that, David, isn't there, really? I'm struggling to know where to start, if I'm really honest. But I think before I spoke to you, I wanted to really... I think your report is brilliant. And there's, you know, I really recommend people go and read it because it's a tremendous piece of work. And probably the most significant document for community pharmacy, in my opinion, in England for, I don't know, longer than I've been qualified, 15, 20 years anyway. Probably more, and maybe doing you an injustice there. But the key thing that sort of came out for me, do you think the community pharmacy value proposition is good enough?
Yes, I do believe that. I just don't believe it's been recognised or seized or we've operationalised it. And I kind of think the government recognised that as well. I think they want that, but I think we've got to listen more carefully to what they're saying to us. And then we've got to change the way we operate quite dramatically to deliver that. So I talk about pharmacy technicians. I don't think we have enough of them in community. And I know why we don't have enough, because when we train them up, they go and then work elsewhere. And so that you invest all this time in developing someone who then takes a job in another environment. However, I think the dispensing process might be contentious here, but the dispensing process is a technical process nowadays. It needs oversight, needs supervision, because there are always difficult things that come in. But I think the pharmacist's skill is with the patient and supporting the patient and making those brief interventions, those public health interventions, but also supporting patients with chronic disease. And I think equally, you know, with prescribing rights, I think they'll take that traditional initial role of supporting patients when they've got a minor ailment or an initial disease. And I think, you know, there's a whole raft of things they can do. And that network provides value to the NHS. It's a barrier to the NHS. I think in COVID, we saw how community pharmacists probably took a lot of workload that would have been going to GPs and A&E. I know my GP land has been very quiet. I know A&E has been very quiet. Patients must be going elsewhere. Now, some of them, I think, are just sitting at home. But I also think the one thing that's been left open on the high street has been the community pharmacist. And the one set of people who have told me how busy and stressed they are community pharmacists. And all I can imagine is the patients are choosing now again to go there first because they don't want to go into a GP practice where there's people with infection and they don't want to go to A&E. So I think COVID has actually nicely highlighted the potential community pharmacy has. But it can only deliver that potential if it's not sat in the back, the pharmacists managing the dispensing process. I think they've got to really take the nettle and become a healthcare professional who's actually responding more directly to patients and using their consultation rooms and providing much more closer face-to-face patient care.
And do you think there's been a deprofessionalization of pharmacists working in community pharmacy over the years?
I think there's been attempts to address that. I think that is the case. I think as, you know, the pharmaceutical industry now produces 99% of medicines, even the specials, so the whole pharmaceutical expertise we need to create extemps has kind of almost disappeared. Obviously, the NHS took away the need for patients to go to the pharmacies first for advice, and so that became something that happened at the weekend, but less so during the week. And you're absolutely right. The pharmacist's role has centered around supplying medicines, as the number of medicines we've dispensed has rocketed. So we need more efficient ways of supplying medicines. I think the safety around medicine supply has increased as IT has taken over. Automation contentiously, you know, addresses that and helps with that. So I think the pharmacist has a role as being the healthcare professional on the high street. I think the government have said that a number of times, but I'm not sure we've totally seized that yet.
I think your point about vision is critical. I mean, before I asked that or we discussed that, I'm looking through a Scottish lens here, I'll admit, and a lot of my thinking is based on, although the concept has evolved radically since 1990, a lot of my thinking is through the lens of pharmaceutical care. So do you, 30 years on from Hepler and Strand's excellent paper, do you think pharmaceutical care is still relevant? And if so, how does that, I'm asking you sort of to almost maybe an unfair question. I'd like you to go beyond your report because anybody can read it. But what I'm interested in is where you think the vision should go. And my view is that pharmaceutical care should be part of that. We should reinvent it. But I'm just keen to understand what you think about that.
Yeah, so I'm totally with you on the pharmaceutical care. I'm still a pharmaceutical care person. And if you read, I took it out of the report because the report was too big. But I had all of the team, we all did a one-page, two-page synopsis of ourselves and where we're coming from so people could understand our backgrounds and what our views were about community pharmacy. And I described the community pharmacist as the pharmaceutical care advocate. And that's kind of where I'd like to see it. It's the person who's there, the patient recognises, when I've got problems with my medicines, I go to them and they then manage that and support me through the process, either as my voice in speaking to the GP or in helping me decide how best to use their medicines or take those medicines or think about how we may swap them. And I think the community pharmacist really has a place there. And I think it all comes under the auspices of pharmaceutical care. I know in England, we like to have our own words. We've gone to medicines management. We've now medicines optimisation. But in my head, they're all pharmaceutical care. And my research area really is care homes. And I'm working with a team in Aberdeen with Professor Bond. And it's all about putting pharmaceutical care plans, still using that language, in care homes. And it doesn't matter who does it. It can be the community pharmacist. There's absolutely no reason why it couldn't be the community pharmacist. It's just the model seems to have been taken away from them and has been moved into GP practices. And it all hinges on that link and that relationship. And so you'll see in the report, I'm recommending a community pharmacy integration centre, a centre which is focused on developing community pharmacy services which are integrated into clinical pathways. I think we've spent too long developing services which don't require working closely with GPs. So the MUR being a great example of a pharmacist service which wasn't wired into the healthcare system, created initially quite a lot of problems for GPs and relationship wise as well, because we're not working in an integrated way. And I have to say, I'm mildly upset by the comment, this is the most important report for 30 years, because I did the literature review under the Murray Review. And I thought that was quite important, but obviously it wasn't implemented in the same way. But again, you know, the recommendations were, we need doctors and pharmacists working to the same agenda. So we need the same targets so that we're working as a team towards it rather than in competition towards it. And pharmaceutical care is our expertise. That's what gives us our unique selling point. So we need to focus on that element and take that responsibility and worry away from the GP and make them realize we can do that for them. And actually take away those emergency supply requests and those patient concerns that come up and take up their time, which community pharmacy can deliver just as well. But all under the auspices of pharmacy. So I must admit, I like that Scotland's kept that language. And I don't know why we ever had to change it in England, but I get the feeling it's all about communication and it's about choosing language that the patient will understand.
I think my view on it is, yes, the implementation in Scotland is second to none. You can't argue with it. Very close relationship. The network is interlocked with the leadership at Community Pharmacy Scotland. It's all very open, and you know, open business, and the council, you know what's happening. There's very little sort of smoke and mirrors and so on. And then that relationship seems to be very, very close with Scottish Government as well. And it's, you know, we're all in it together. I'm sure behind closed doors when they're negotiating, I know nearly all the personalities personally, and I would be very surprised if there wasn't raised voices and, you know, very robust conversations. But at the end of the day, it's they're in there to find the win-win, and so far they have. But I want to take you back to pharmaceutical care, because I think the decision to stick with I'm keen to hear your view on this. The decision to stick with it was a good one from a business point of view, because I always think businesses or people buy, one, because they think they're going to really benefit, or two, they really think they're going to suffer if they don't buy. Now, pharmaceutical care was clever, in my opinion, mainly because it focused actually on the negative. And it focused on, you know, adverse drug reactions and harm from medicines, or and it positioned pharmacists as the goalkeeper. Now, no one else, no other discipline, in my view, is really interested in that, and no one does it better.
No.
But I wondered, I wondered what you thought about my view as well about the opportunity I see coming down the track, which is an insurance policy sell, as it were, would be the supply chain argument. Do you think the fact that community pharmacy could protect the supply chain in times of war or pandemic or emergency, do you think that's enough of a value proposition to keep pharmaceutical, or to get pharmaceutical care back on the agenda, or am I talking rubbish?
I'm not sure entirely I understand the question. What you're saying, I think, is actually, you know, does the supply function justify all these other things? So could these other things survive without the supply function? I think the supply function adds an important part to it, because if the patients have somewhere they need to go to collect their medicine or to receive their medicine from, it allows that human interaction. And I think if everything's done sort of the Amazon way, where it's delivered to your door and someone runs down the drive before you open it, I think we lose something quite dramatic. I suppose what you're saying, is there any value in that? And I think that's for us to show. I think that's for us to demonstrate. I think that's where the weakness has been. And that's why people like me exist, is to try and develop that evidence base, and to show that actually seeing someone who comes in for cough medicine and then identify that they're at stage 2 of COPD and we could stop them moving to stage 3, and that in intervention itself has incredible value to the NHS. And those sort of things we can do, which result from patients coming in and getting to know us and building that relationship and trusting us, means the NHS gets a lot more from a system very cheaply. You know, we rely on the income that comes elsewhere, not just from the prescriptions, but I think we can add a lot more to that. You take away those medicines, and you take away the reason for the patient going on the high street, the reason for the patient come into the community pharmacy, it then becomes more difficult to add the value of pharmaceutical care proposition on top. So I think the two are sort of interwoven, to be honest. But I think we need to do the supply as efficiently as possible, but make sure we add significant value to that. And there's so many ways we can do that.
Mm-hmm. I think I wanted to touch on communication as well. I think your point about communication is really interesting, because obviously pharmacy in practice sort of tries to keep up with the news and keep everyone up to date and so on and so forth. And I don't wish to sound rude or anything like that, but my impression of the news, in inverted commas, that comes out of England is it's very reactionary, isn't it? And you know, you'll get one topic that'll pop up unexpectedly, and then all the myriad of different organizations will all come out with their press releases, and they're all jockeying for position, and there's no, I think I just wanted to say that I think your point about communication is very apt, because it's what I see really. How could that be improved, do you think, then, based on your recommendations?
Okay, so a little bit of this recommendation and the thing about the comms comes from my working with the pharmaceutical industry. So I've worked with a company for many years, and now I see how they operate, and I see how getting a news story into the press can get massive traction for their product or for whatever they want to do. And it just made me realize community pharmacy doesn't do that. We react to things. We don't actually set the agenda. And what I would like us to do is to set the agenda, is decide what things we want to release, what things we want to push, and to use news stories to get the community pharmacy presence much better felt and much more positive than it is. I think the issue is if you try and do that as Company Chemists Association or Association of Independent Multiples, it's self-interested. And I think what you've got to do is do this collegiately. And one thing that came out I hadn't realized was they are working together. So they've decided that the PSNC, CCAAM and the MPA want to work on a comm strategy, but there's no resource to push it. And so actually they've got together, but they've not actually done anything about it because there's nobody in there who's got the time to work on that agenda in a more proactive manner. So just, I think it's something I've been wanting to say for a while is, I don't know if you've read Bad Pharma, the book about what the pharmaceutical industry do to manipulate evidence. Well, one of the stories in there that really shocked me was about community pharmacy. A number of years ago, the government wanted community pharmacies to be able to change branded products to generics as soon as they spotted them. Ben Goldacre, sorry, that's the author. And so they wanted to give the power to community pharmacists, which they do hospital pharmacists, get a branded product, swap to the generic. Within a few weeks, the patients' associations were coming out saying community pharmacists don't have the skills, they're too financially interested, this should never be allowed, so the government dropped the idea. What Ben Goldacre says in his book is that it was all funded by pharma. Pharma decided they didn't want community pharmacies taking this role because it would save them, cost them a lot of money. So they paid patients' associations to, indirectly, to voice these opinions, which MPs listen to. We don't do any of that in pharmacy. We don't use those patient voices. When we're unhappy with something, we state it as pharmacists. Pharmacists complaining about something is just self-interested. We need to be more clever in the way we communicate, and we need to realize when the voice of the patient will help our case far more than the voice of the pharmacist. And we're just not looking at things in a strategic manner. So there are things we could learn from the pharma industry. They're not always good practices, but actually the things they do to get the right messages out there that they want are very effective. And they're not that expensive. That's the other thing that surprised me. You know, with the right media stories and the right media releases, with a clear goal as to what you're trying to achieve, you can achieve a lot with not a lot of money.
Well, one thing's for sure, berating representatives of the NHS or members of Parliament on social media is certainly not going to help our cause as pharmacists either. I think that's probably the extreme end of what you're describing. But yes, I have seen some of the more subtle communication strategies as well. And I agree, they don't cost much, but it's just about being coordinated, and but it comes back to your point again, David, about the lack of strategy, the lack of vision. Where are we going to be in 5 years? Where are we going to be in 10 years? Where are we going to be in 20? You know, if you, apologies for bringing it back to Scotland, but, you know, CPS and Scottish Government have agreed really that the need to build quality into the community pharmacy network. So that means investing in, and they've done this already, investing in training pharmacists to be prescribers, facilitating that to happen. They're already looking at things like, they've already spent money on things like experiential learning in community pharmacy. All this stuff is really, it's really early days. I think they would admit that as well. But the other thing is competence-based frameworks to make sure the pharmacists and pharmacy technicians are properly trained and signed off actually as competent. So I just don't see any of that in England. And that's why your report, on the positive side, that's why your report is so timely. A few sort of checks and balances here. Who paid for the report?
The PSNC and LPCs between them. So they split it in the way they split the levy. So the PSNC paid 30% and the LPC 70%. It was £70,000. We were very cheap when you think how much work we put into that report and how many people we spoke to and what we did.
That's extremely cheap for, in my opinion, for what you've produced. I think they owe you a pint, David, to be honest.
They do, actually. Yeah, they do. At least one. But just one. I actually say in the report, I suddenly realised what I'd taken on. I suddenly realised how I'd undercosted the whole process. But then I worked out what the goal was. It took a few weeks, and I suddenly realised this was about giving community pharmacy a stronger voice and getting a better contract. And I kind of think that's my job as an academic, is to question the status quo and try and move the world forward, even marginally. You know, that's what we're about, and coming at these things from a different perspective. So I think the report has shocked everybody, and it shocked me, to be honest, in the breadth of recommendations that came with. But that's what I was paid to do. And I think the 70,000 came from the recognition, again, that this had to provide value to the contractor. They didn't want to be spending £200,000 or £300,000 on a report and then the contractor saying, well, there's our money wasted again. So I think, you know, hopefully they will see the 70,000 as providing good value, which is what the whole process was about.
Well, I think they might have got more than they bargained for in terms of doing a proper job. So, look, congratulations on that. Who benefits from the report, do you think? Who's going to win here and who's going to lose?
Right. OK, well, I really hope the contractors benefit. I think if they don't, then obviously it was a bad report and I'm not doing a good job. And I'll accept that. But I think we've got to try the recommendations and put them into place. I think the LPCs benefit because they work independently of each other. That's one of the things that shocked me. There's this massive network of LPCs all operating in their own areas with little cross-contamination, cross-learning. And so I came across this disease that you won't find in any medical book called pilotitis, where they're all doing pilots of new services because the same drivers coming from the top. Locally, they're coming up with the same ideas. And then what they're doing, everybody's doing a service with community pharmacy, which they call a pilot because there's no evidence to back it up. And actually what may have happened is somebody may have done that a year ago elsewhere and has the learning, but you don't know about that in another part of the country. And so I think that creating that network will make the LPC stronger. And I think putting them in the centre will make them understand how government works and what the barriers are and why the PSNC has operated as it has for many years and what problems it's had to deal with. The loser, I think, in this is the other PSNC committee members themselves, because they I interviewed just about all of them, my colleague and I did, Michael, and they were good people. They were all there for the right reason. They were all working hard for community pharmacy, and I couldn't criticise any of them or any of their responses. They all said incredibly sensible things to me. It just dawned on me at the end of it that the structure's wrong. They can keep working as they are and they stay as they are. But until the contractor feels closer to the centre, until that the LPCs feel that there's no secrecy and there's no gap between the two of them, and the only way we can do that is by putting them in the middle, I don't think it'll work. I don't think the negotiations will work. So I think, unfortunately, the PSNC members who have been there, a lot of them, a long time, will eventually sort of disappear back probably to the LPCs or back into other roles. So I think they're probably the losers, but they've all done more than their fair share of time, I think, just about on the PSNC. I'm hoping the patients are winners, to be honest with you, because I think, you know, if we get a better community pharmacy contract, which is more patient-focused, then patients will get a more professional service and better outcomes. And people ask me what my driver was. I got, at the start of the process, I got a lot of emails asking me who was paying me, what was my original plan? You know, what was the goal here? And there was a lot of suspicion in the system. The system has not been used to anybody coming in and looking at it from the outside before. And so I kind of recognized that email. They, you know, they weren't always the most pleasant to receive. But I didn't mind answering them because I hadn't got a preset agenda. My preset agenda was to deliver for contractors. But there was one I never told about. And it was, as an academic, students aren't choosing pharmacy anymore. Not in the way they were. The numbers have gone down year and year and year in England. And so every school of pharmacy is shrinking at the moment. And if they're not shrinking, they're taking students with lower and A-level grades. And I think predominantly the reason for that is community pharmacy has always been the thing that sold pharmacy to 18, 17-year-olds in the past. And I send my students out on placements. And a number of them come back and say, the pharmacist said to me, why did you choose that as a degree? This is not a profession you want to come in. And I've heard that so many times from community pharmacy visits from my students and the community pharmacy saying that, it's made me realize how low morale there is in the system at the moment. And that low morale then pervades much wider than just community pharmacy. It pervades the whole profession and it pervades who comes in at the bottom, the students. And if we're not getting good quality applicants, we're not getting a large number of applicants, we're going to have the same problem the GPs had, shortages of staff. And it won't just be in the community sector, it'll be in the hospital sector and the primary care sector, because there's only so many going to come out in the next few years.
Yeah, very interesting, David. One thing that caught my eye was the fact that you, in your new governing body that you suggested fixed terms. I think it was, from memory, it was three-year terms. Is that right?
No, so what I said was that the governance book, which is what it should be, says 3 by 3 years. I've said I recognise if we do that, I think we'd lose too many people. So I've given a bit more latitude and said 3 by 4 years, but I kind of think that's where we should be moving towards, yeah.
And what was your thinking behind that?
There was a number of things. First of all, there was clear feeling that these committees have been the same people for too many years. And there needs to be young people coming through. And if you've got the same people all the way, no one's ever going to apply because they think, well, it's a closed shop. Why bother joining? And if you don't want to go into somewhere where it's not dynamic, where everybody knows each other, they're all friends together. And so you're just not getting, and the LPC's told me this, they just don't get many applicants now to go on the LPC. So I think we need to get rid of that staleness, as people described it. And I think it pervades throughout the whole world of pharmacy. I think everything we look at in pharmacy has no limit to the number of years on it, and the world I live in, academia, that's all adopted a number of years ago. So I'm never on anything for more than 5 years or 9 years is the absolute maximum. And at the time you get to the end of 9 years, you think, well, that's terrible. But actually, it means you move on, you do something else, and it means that committee gets fresh blood. But actually, the thing that really struck me was this diversity thing. Was if you've got people on a committee who've been there 10, 20, 30 years ago, they no longer reflect the diversity of the people they're representing. They reflect the diversity of the people they're representing 20, 30, 40 years ago. So the only way you can ensure you get that reflection, really, apart from level playing field and all the things you have to do to ensure that that happens, is to have that churn and have people turn over so that actually that committee is more recent and reflects much more better the contractors it's representing. So I kind of think, that was the one thing actually that surprised me. I was expecting a lot of trouble about the committee, the council, and all the other things I've suggested. But the one thing that has come up a few times is this: but we're going to lose people. We're going to lose all this knowledge that we've got, and you know, really, do we have to let people move after 9 or 12 years? And my kind of feeling is, we've just got to do it. We've got to modernise. We've got to actually move from this, the same people always being there, to letting people come through with new ideas, fresh perspectives, to actually change the system. And I think, you know, one thing I've learned in pharmacy, the status quo in pharmacy is status quo. And I think that this one thing, if we can get this changed, I think that would help a lot, actually. And I think it would send a signal to all the other representative bodies as well that they probably could do with a similar sort of governance strategies.
Absolutely. And the reason I brought that up was, well, A, it caught my eye, but B, 3 or 4 years ago when I was in the RPS, Scottish Pharmacy Board, I suggested the same thing. And I know that's been debated in the RPS for a number of years. And actually, after I made that suggestion, a number of people took on the idea and ran with it. So, yeah, these things are never perfect, are they? But there is an optimum, and someone being on a committee for 25 years is kind of hard to justify from a number of reasons, including the diversity angle as well.
So just to add to that, a few people were hadn't recognised that actually you can go off and come back on. There's nothing to stop that. You just go off for at least one session, and then if you want to apply to come back, you can. So it's not kind of you're banned for life. And what was interesting, I think, about that question is this appropriate to let people go? We're going to lose all that knowledge. They're not moving away. They're not dying. They're still there. They're still in your area. If you really need that knowledge, you can still pick up the phone, you know. So it's kind of, I don't kind of get the, you know, well, we're going to lose all that knowledge we've had and all that experience. They're still part of the team, but this is kind of the modern culture now of not keeping everybody in the same place forever.
But I find, I mean, the wider discussion about that is that, is one I find interesting. And I suppose when I got onto the RPS board, I think I went a rather atypical route through some, you know, short-term notoriety on social media and then, you know, managed to get voted on. And suddenly I found myself in this, I don't know how to describe it, like political bubble. My experience was only that organization, but running Pharmacy and Practice, I've sort of had a glimpse of the rest of politics and pharmacy. And honestly, trying to get stuff done, it's kind of like running through treacle. It's kind of tricky. And I think things are changing, and your report is a watershed moment, perhaps, but also individuals can now, well, arguably like me, can just bypass the system and have a voice. Whether it's right that we have such a loud voice is up for debate. I recognize that. But given how little has changed for so many years, I do think an element of disruption is probably helpful and justified, as long as we have responsibility with how we communicate. But I don't know what you think of, whether you have any thoughts on that, David.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of thinking, you know, this will make it more attractive to people to apply to be on these. They suddenly realise by being on the LPC, their voice will be heard nationally, and they know it will be heard nationally. And in fact, if they're there long enough, they can actually be on that national council. So I kind of think actually it'll suddenly make the LPCs look far more attractive propositions, because I know they were all worried about, well, if we suddenly put a time point in, we lose all our members, where are we going to get new ones from? But I suddenly think what we're offering to these people outside who aren't in there is an opportunity now to have a voice and to change things at the centre. And really, it kind of made me realise how powerful the PSNC could potentially be, or Community Pharmacy England as it would be, because actually that's where the money is. So the RPS worries about the individuals and the profession, which is rightly so, but actually this is the contract. This is what pharmacists do, and this is what we're paid to do, and this kind of defines everything in many respects. So actually I think this is a far more exciting proposition for contractors than going down the RPS route, because actually this is about community pharmacy locally, and community pharmacy in England.
Absolutely. Let's finish on a positive. So Hepler and Strand brought out their paper in 1990. We're now 30 years after that, obviously. Take yourself forward 10, 15, 20, let's say 20 years. What could you describe your perfect community pharmacy in 20 years?
Yeah, okay. So my community pharmacy will not look like the community pharmacy of today. I don't think we will be selling anything other than medicines, to be honest, or medicines related medical products. I think if we look at optometry, opticians, I think they're a good example of somewhere you go into and you feel you're in a professional environment, airy, well lit, plenty of consultation rooms, and you won't expect to be given your medicines in a bag. You'll be expected to sit down with someone and they will hand those medicines to you because they'll recognize there's value in there. And they will have a chat with you every time, even if it's just saying, how are you doing? Is there anything I can help you with? And just let them go. But actually, this sort of handing a bag over a counter in public view, I think it's really kind of not really where we want to be as a profession. And I want to be in a place where you can sit down, you get to know your patients really well, talk to them privately, and give them a chance for a quick interaction if need be, and see what you can help them with, but actually add some value to that medicine supply process. For those patients who want to do that, I think direct selling is already taken off as a result of COVID, so that's a separate thing. But I think patients want to go somewhere where they're being dealt with by healthcare professionals. They know their medicines are supplied accurately. Any medicines problems are resolved by a pharmacy technician who's managing that whole process. And then they're talking to a pharmacist or talking to all the healthcare trained people about their medicines, and they're getting that added value at that point. So it's either the yearly review, the monthly repeat, but actually stopping them having to go to the doctors to repeat the prescription, order the prescription, and then go to the pharmacy to collect it, you know, and trying to work out how best we can work together to get the medicine supply to minimize disruption to the patient, but actually maximize the outcomes to them from their medicines. And I think that that's where we want to be as a healthcare professional. And interesting, when I spoke to NHS England for the Murray Review, you know, one of their concerns was about community pharmacy seen as part of NHS. This was a number of years ago because of the way the premises looked. And again, you know, one of the things we need to start thinking about in that negotiation process is how can we get some extra funding to make our premises look more like an NHS location and more like somewhere where a patient gets healthcare rather than someone goes in and buys products and gets some advice on the side, which may well be the patient perception at the moment. So I think it's a very different world to the one we're at. But I think the pharmacists themselves will be in a much nicer, professionally rewarding world, where they can actually, if the patient's dose needs changing, they can change it. The patient hasn't got to go see the GP to have it done. It can be done there and then. They can take the blood pressure, take the cholesterol, take the HbA1c, whatever test, they should have all those available to them. And they should be able to actually access them straight through to the hospital if need be, rather than having to use point of care tests. And all of that is such that the patient gets a much more, what's the word, refined system. Not this bouncing between healthcare professionals getting different advice. And the pharmacist knows when they talk to the patient giving advice, they're giving the advice the doctor would give to them. They're both talking in the same wavelength because they both have had the same training and are both working towards the same goal. But the GP's job, in my mind, is that diagnosis, identifying, starting new treatments. Community pharmacy job is the chronic disease management and stopping the patient having to go and access the GP all the while because their 3 month review or the 6 month review is up.
Lovely. I think if we got the prospect of doing pharmacy for youngsters would be a lot more attractive at the moment. So that seems like a really nice place to finish, David. We've never met in person. This is the first time we've chatted. Oh. So it's been really cool, and I've probably not done justice to your comprehensive report. I've selfishly gone in and talked about, you know, aspects that I was interested in. So I'm sure others will cover other bits of it. But listen, I wish you all the best with it. Very brave, forward thinking piece of work. And I can tell you when my business gets to the point of commissioning academic work, I'm gonna phone you because you're dead cheap.
I've learned my lesson. Absolutely. I think I've said that 5 times now. So yeah, probably have.
Make sure and get that piked off PSNC. That's for sure.
All right.
Pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, so much. See you soon. Yes. Bye.